You're listening to Why Won't Atheists Just Man Up? Atheism and the Burden of Proof by Michael Horner. Michael is an apologist with Power to Change and an adjunct professor of philosophy at Trinity Western University in Langley, British Columbia. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 9, 2013 at Northview Community Church.
So the title of this talk is Why Won't Atheists Just Man Up? Atheism and the Burden of Proof. Now, I know that's a bit of a cheeky title. All right? Maybe that's why you came. I don't know. And I don't want to give any misimpression here. I'm not the kind of guy that wants to promote some sort of triumphalism over our opponents or over atheisms. Rather, I really do want to promote respect and civility, like Dr. Craig displays. You know, he gives great answers to questions, but he does it with a gracious spirit, with respect and civility. But I admit, the title's a little bit cheeky, and I need to tell you why. After 27 years of debating atheists, I found very few actually debate and really defend atheism, or at least defend the question, their answer to the question, does God exist? The view that there is no God. They actually refuse to debate that issue, really. Even after clarifying ahead of time, and I always do this when I set up debates, that the view they're supposed to defend is the view called atheism, which traditionally means the no answer to the question, does God exist? Not maybe God does or doesn't exist, or I don't know if God doesn't exist, not agnosticism, but no, God does not exist. Those are the guys I want to debate, and we set it up that way, and they always agree to it. But then when we get into the debate, they refuse to debate that question. Now, there are arguments against God's existence. We've heard some of them in the Q&A last night with Dr. Craig. The problem of evil and suffering is probably the most common one. There's one called the problem of God's hiddenness. You know, why isn't God make his truth more evident than it is? Some people talk about the incoherence of God's attributes. There are arguments for God's non-existence. Why don't they use them in debates? And they do use them in other settings. These same people I'm talking about, they'll use them in their writings. They'll use them in personal conversations. But in the debate, they don't use them. Why? I suspect it's because they know they don't actually work. They know the arguments in the end ultimately don't win out over the theistic answers to them. If they did, think about it. You can be absolutely sure they'd be using them. I mean, if they knew these arguments really worked, that would be the first thing they would want to give in the debates, right? Win the argument, embarrass the Christian, theist, settle the issue. But the fact that they don't, and instead prefer to say things like, well, you can't prove a negative. God doesn't exist. Or the absence of evidence for God is enough to establish that God doesn't exist. Or I merely lack the belief that God exists. I don't actually believe that God doesn't exist. You catch that one? I don't actually believe that God doesn't exist. I merely lack the belief that God does exist. Well, it tells me that they know the arguments that God, for God's non-existence just really aren't that strong. Last May, Dr. Paul Chamberlain and I, a colleague from Trinity Western University, debated at an atheist convention. We actually got invited to an atheist convention in Kamloops, B.C. Were any of you there, by chance? Okay, there were a lot of people from Christians from Kamloops who were there, and people from the Valley. So this is kind of going into the lion's den, right? And I thought, for sure, we're going to get some guys that are really going to come after us with arguments. But more than anyone else, they refused to debate. They refused to defend the claim that, no, God doesn't exist, and they resorted to these three very claims. Can't defend the negative. Absence of evidence is enough to establish God's non-existence. Or, no, we merely lack the belief. And they put the entire burden of proof on us. It's all on you guys to prove God does exist. And if you fail, then we are rationally justified in concluding God doesn't exist. And more than that, you have to prove that God exists with absolutely every detail, every attribute of God. And I compared it to, they said, we have to jump over a bar that's 8 feet high, which would break the world high jump record. And they only have to kind of step over a string, to kind of win the debate. It's just a debating strategy, I think, is what's going on here. So the question that I want to discuss in this presentation is the burden of proof. Do they really have a burden of proof or not? And I suggest that both the atheist and the theist have a burden of proof because we're both making important knowledge claims. We're both claiming to know something. I'm claiming to know that God does exist. And so I do have a burden of proof. And I'll hold up to that. I'll present arguments for it. But I suggest that they have a burden of proof as well because they're claiming to know that God does not exist. That's what atheism traditionally has meant. And so as such, both views have to shoulder a burden of proof. So we're going to look at the three counterarguments that I presented that are common among atheists to this claim that they have to shoulder some burden of proof for their atheism. I mean, to be honest, after the Kamloops debate, I had enough. That's it. I was fed up after 27 years of this, and I decided I was going to do some real thorough research on this and say, is there really anything to what they're saying? Do they, you know, are they justified in claiming they don't have any burden of proof or not? And after doing some thorough research and writing some blog posts on it, I'm here to tell you that no, they are not justified, and I'm going to show that each one of their arguments completely fails. And next time I do a debate, if they start doing this again, I tell you, I'm not going to let them get away with it. Thank you very much. Nicely. So here's their first argument. But atheism is just a negative claim, and we all know negative claims have no burden of proof. Only positive claims do. So atheist truth claim is a negative one. That is, God does not exist. And as such, they say there's no burden to prove it. The burden of proof, they say, is only and always on the person making the positive claim, the theist, not the one making the negative claim. Now, this is one of those statements that it's been repeated so many times in the area of philosophy and even in popular conversation that it just seems like it's true. But is it? Richard Dawkins, for example, admits surprisingly easily that no one could prove atheism. Isn't that kind of interesting to hear? He admits no one can prove atheism, and that's not concluded by all atheists, conceded by all atheists. But then Dawkins insists that to ask for such a proof is absurd. No such proof is necessary. It's not up to the atheist to prove God does not exist. It's up to the theist to prove he does. Why does he say this? Well, to support his contention, Dawkins refers to fictional characters such as the Tooth Fairy, Mother Goose, Santa Claus, the Flying Spaghetti Monster of cyberspace, even Bertrand Russell's famous celestial teapot from the 1940s. It would be absurd to say, he says, to call on people who do not believe in these fictional characters to prove their non-existence. The burden of proof is on those who do believe in them. Well, there's definitely a kernel of truth in what he's saying there. There's something to what he's saying. Similarly, he says, though, those who believe in God are the ones who have the duty to prove he does exist, not the other way around. Well, my colleague in the two-on-two debate, it was a two-on-two debate, Paul Chamberlain and myself against a guy named Christopher DiCarlo, atheist from Ontario, and Matt Dilhunty, an atheist from Texas, at this Kamloops Atheist Convention. Paul, this was sort of Paul's area of the debate. We divided up our roles, and the burden of proof was his area, and he did a great, great job during the debate with this. And Paul leads the Institute for Christian Apologetics at ACTS Seminary here, and if you ever want to study apologetics, this is the only place in Canada where you can actually do it and get a graduate degree in it. So I really encourage that. So he handled this beautifully. He countered, he says, well, what shall we say to this line of reasoning concerning the burden of proof? Why should anyone think Dawkins is correct in thinking the burden of proof is strictly and always on the person making the positive claim, God exists, and never on those making negative assertions, God does not exist. The fact is that every truth claim, whether it's positive or negative, he says, has a burden of proof, since it's a claim to know something. And since knowledge can be properly defined as justified or warranted true belief. That's how knowledge is defined in philosophy. Knowledge is justified or warranted true belief. It's a true belief you have that you are justified in having or warranted in having. Then a claim to know God does not exist requires some justification or some warrant, or it can't be knowledge. So it needs to be some sort of justification or warrant for it. So when it comes to the question of God, clearly both atheists and theists are claiming to know something is true. God exists, says the theist. He does not, replies the atheist. Both claim to tell us something important about the world, about the universe. One says it has God in it, the other says it doesn't. It's hard to see what it is, therefore, about negative truth claims that free them from having to be justified or supported in some way. So Chamberlain asks the following question at the debate. He says, consider what happens to Dawkins' contention when we simply substitute other illustrations in place of his fictional characters. And this was beautiful. I mean, Paul's a very bright man. He says, what if a friend told you he did not believe pineapples existed? Or rhinoceroses existed? Or George Washington? Or Winston Churchill? Or Nero never lived, existed as historical figures? Suppose he went even further and insisted that the World Trade Centers were not attacked on 9/11, or that the Holocaust never occurred in the 1940s. I mean, do we say that Holocaust deniers have no burden of proof? The exact opposite. We put the burden of proof on anyone who denies the Holocaust existed, and yet it's a negative claim. See, suddenly things seem very different when you have different examples in there. Notice these are all negative truth claims about some state of affairs in the world. They tell us something is not the case. And in this sense, they resemble the atheist truth claim that there is no God. So does their negativity alone free them from having to give some sort of reason that they're true? Hardly. So these examples show that the burden of proof does not hinge merely on whether an assertion is positive or negative, as Dawkins seems to assume. But why then does it seem to do that in Dawkins' examples? Because it did seem kind of right, you know, Dawkins' examples, right? Sort of the Tooth Fairy and Mother Goose and so on. Aha, Chamberlain points out the reason is because he's restricted his illustrations to trivial characters which were intended to be fictional in the first place and are recognized as such by anyone talking about them. His examples are kind of skewing the whole argument. He strategically used these fictional characters because his argument only works with characters such as those. No one is asking for evidence that the Tooth Fairy does not exist. Why? Because no one ever thought Tooth Fairy did exist. It's not the negativity of the claims that releases them from needing any proof for their triviality. When we simply substitute normal historical characters such as Plato, Nero, Winston Churchill, or George Washington, or serious historical events like the Holocaust and 9/11, in place of these fictional characters, it becomes clear that anyone denying the existence of these people or events has a burden of proof equal to, and in some cases even greater than, the person claiming they do exist. So in the debate, the atheist claimed that the burden of proof is only on the person making the positive claim, the theist, not the one making the negative claim, the atheist. So Paul says, is this always true in the cross-examination time we had during our debate? Yes, was the unequivocal reply by Matt Dilhunty. When asked if a person making the negative claim, quote, the Holocaust did not occur, has a burden of proof for his claim, Matt wavered slightly. And you can actually catch this debate online. The Institute for Christian Apologetics has it online right now. Stated that if the person is saying he did not believe the Holocaust occurred, that is the absence of belief in the Holocaust, he has no burden of proof. However, if he's saying he believes the Holocaust did not occur, he does have a burden of proof. Because now he's throwing in another little wrinkle. So we pointed out at that point that so far this has amounted to an admission to our first argument that key negative claims do have a burden of proof. If you are claiming the Holocaust did not occur, or analogously, God does not exist, you do have a burden of proof. They just conceded that point, whether they realize it or not. Now later in my presentation, I'm going to come back to the point about just lacking belief in the Holocaust or lacking belief in God. But first, I want to tell you a story about how I met the most formidable atheist in the 20th century, how I met Anthony Flew. Anthony Flew was the most formidable atheist in the 20th century. He was a thorn in the side of theists from the 1940s and 50s right on into the 20th century. I was doing my graduate work at the University of Toronto in philosophy, and I just finished writing a paper on the problem of miracles. Whether miracles could happen or not, whether it's possible to identify them if they could happen. And Flew was famous for his argument against that, together with the famous David Hume, the skeptic, you know, from the 17th, 18th century, who also argued against miracles. And so I wrote this paper. I just finished handing it in to my professor before I got on this plane ride down to Dallas. The title of my paper was, "Have You Caught the Hume Flu?" Now, I don't always give cheeky titles. I know this is the title, this is cheeky, and that was titled cheeky, but those are probably the only two cheeky titles I've ever had, to be quite honest. But that was a cheeky title, and I used a pun on the word flu, flu being the flu bug, and the name flu, F-L-E-U, which was his name, comparing his arguments with David Hume, and I was arguing against Hume and flu. I get on the plane, and then there's this guy sitting across the aisle from me towards the back of the plane. Elderly gentleman, didn't know who he was, didn't recognize him or anything, but I noticed he was reading some philosophy books, and I wanted to strike up a conversation. It was across the aisle, so it was a little bit difficult, and I was at the back of the plane, which is where the engines were, so that made it even more difficult. But I struck up a conversation, and before too long, I realized I was actually talking to Anthony Flew. He was from England, but he was at York University. I was at the University of Toronto. He's at York University in Northern Toronto as a visiting professor at the time. And we were both on our way to the same conference, the first conference for atheists and theists back in 1985. And he was very friendly, a great conversationalist. We were having a great time. I was scared out of my boots. I'll be honest with you. I was a young guy in my 30s, and I'll be honest with you, I did not tell him I just wrote a paper entitled, "Have You Caught the Hume Flu?" I did not get to that. But Anthony Flew is famous for his arguments that we should presume atheism is true when everything else is equal. It sort of should be the default position. But, interestingly enough, Flew does admit that there's something wrong with this negative claims don't need don't have a burden of proof. After quoting an old Latin phrase in one of his writings, the Latin phrase means, quote, "The onus of proof lies on the man who affirms positive claims, not on the man who denies negative claims." He then writes this response. He says the response is equally obvious, quote, "Given just a very little verbal ingenuity," Flew says, "the content of any motion can be rendered alternatively in either a negative or positive form." So the claim God does exist or God does not exist, the claim God does exist or the claim God does not exist can be rendered in a positive way, that this house denies the existence of God. That's just a formal debating way of putting it. But that's a positive way of stating the claim, the negative claim, God does not exist. This house denies the existence of God, or that this house takes its stand for positive atheism. His point is, any negative claim can be reworded and put in a positive way. So, interpreted, therefore, he says, our axiom provides no determinant guidance. He disagrees with the idea that negative claims require no burden of proof, because they can just be reworded into a positive way. And if you think positive claims require burden of proof, then all you gotta do is just kind of reword it. So, my point is this, it can't be the negativity of a claim that frees it up from a requirement of proof, since all negative claims can be rephrased in a positive way. Furthermore, there are other variables that often take precedence over whether the claim is positive or negative and tell us who has the burden of proof. Things like initial plausibility to the claim or whether the stakes are high. And these tend to overrule negativity or positivity. For example, initial plausibility. As the philosopher Shandon Guthrie points out, even philosophers who advocate for positive affirmations having the burden of proof acknowledge that if the issue is whether you will die someday, then the burden of proof is on the person who takes the negative side. Okay, so the question at hand is, will you die someday? Yeah. So the person who says no, they seem to have a greater burden of proof than the person who says yes, right? Because the initial plausibility of that seems to favor the positive side. Of course, you're going to die someday. So initial plausibility often overrides negativity or positivity. Another example is when the stakes are really high. Guthrie says, if you're thinking of investing your life savings in a company, you'll want to put a heavy burden of proof on the person who advocates making the investment. Right? And so when the stakes are high, that overrides positivity or negativity. So clearly the stakes are really high when it comes to the two claims, God exists and God doesn't exist. If one is wrong about this issue, one's eternal destiny is at stake. And so both have a burden of proof because the stakes are really high. So it seems it's just not true that negative claims do not also have a burden of proof, possible even more often and to a greater degree than a positive claim. This is not saying that theists don't have a burden of proof. We do. It's just saying atheists also have a burden of proof. And I wish they would man up in debates and let's hear the arguments. Okay. There's a second. Yeah. Sure, go ahead. I'll decide whether we deal with it now or at the end, okay?
When you're talking about who has more to lose or who has more to gain, would you argue that atheists have more to lose? Because if they're wrong, if I'm wrong as a Christian, then nothing happens to me at the end of my life anyway, it's not a big deal. Yeah. But if an atheist is wrong, well...
Very good. That was one of the additional points in my notes that I cut out just for lack of time. That's Blaise Pascal's wager argument. That, you're right, yeah. In terms of if you're down to just making what's the best bet is, yeah, the stakes are really high for the atheist. If he's wrong, his eternal destiny is really in deep trouble. If the theist is wrong, hey, you just die and you don't exist anymore, you know? And you've lost a little bit of maybe fun in this life or something like that. But yeah, that's Pascal's wager. Exactly, right. Very good. Second argument that they bring up is, but absence of evidence equals evidence of absence. In other words, all we have to do show that you, theist, has failed to give enough evidence for your case. And that is enough for me to draw the conclusion that God does not exist. Absence of evidence is evidence of absence, is what they say. This is the assumption most atheists have had in the debates I've had for the last 27 years. They claim in the debates that despite the fact we present them with numerous arguments regarding existence, that they are unable to refute, by the way, usually during these debates, they continue to assert there's no evidence for God's existence, even though we just presented a whole bunch, and therefore they are justified in concluding that atheism is true. Now, it's worth noting, though, that numerous well-known atheists disagree with this point. The late Carl Sagan, for one, explicitly stated in his book, The Dragon of Eden, that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. My former philosophy prof from the University of Calgary, the atheist Kai Nielsen, is famously known for pointing out that even if they were able to refute the arguments for God's existence, for atheists, this would be a case of fallacious reasoning. This aphorism commits the fallacy called the argument from ignorance, and here's what Nielsen says, quote, "To show that an argument is invalid or unsound is not to show that the conclusion of the argument is false. All the proofs for God's existence may fail, but it still may be the case that God exists. In short, to show that the proofs do not work is not enough by itself. It may still be the case that God exists." The philosopher Michael Scriven, another well-known atheist in the 20th century especially, who I also had the privilege of meeting, I got to drive him to the airport after he had a debate with Norman Geisler at the University of Calgary back in 1974. And I was a young undergrad student there, and Norman Geisler just, I hate to use this sort of language, but he cleaned his clock. And Scriven admitted it to me. He says, yeah, I wasn't expecting that good of a theist debater, he says, you know. And he was lamenting the fact that he knew he lost the debate and so on. And then he tried to basically convert me on the way to the airport, but it didn't work. It just gave me more motivation to do what I do now. But anyway, he says, he recognizes that the absence of evidence is not always evidence of absence, and he's written extensively on this. Absence of evidence does not constitute evidence of absence. That is, as his absence of evidence for God's existence does not constitute the evidence of the absence of God. Okay, when we have good reasons for expecting evidence to exist for the postulated entity. If I were to assert that there's an elephant in this room, then failure to observe an elephant would be a good reason to deny the existence of an elephant in this room. But if I was to assert there's a flea in this room, our inability to observe a flea would not be good evidence that there is no flea in this room. Because we wouldn't expect to be able to see a flea in this room. We expect to see an elephant. And so the question is, do we expect to have good evidence for God's existence? So it all depends on whether we expect to have good evidence of the entity, if it existed or not. Now, J.P. Moreland and W.L. Craig have summarized Scriven's criteria in their excellent textbook, Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview. If you are really into this apologetic stuff, you're just loving this weekend, that's a 700-page book that you want to get. I use it, Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview. Now, it's a little bit heavier than some of the other books that are being sold out there, all right? InterVarsity Press, but it's really quite cheap. I mean, InterVarsity sells this book for, it's less than $50. I think sometimes you can get it for $30, $40. For a 700-page book, it is fantastic. I use it in my philosophy courses, okay? It's really very good. They say, we are justified in believing something does not exist, provided that it is not something that might leave no traces, like maybe a flea in this room, and we have comprehensively surveyed the area where the evidence will be found if the entity existed. So, only if we expect to find more evidence, which means, when applied to God, we can only deny that God exists if we expect that God would have left more evidence than he has, and the area where the evidence is expected to be found has been thoroughly and sufficiently searched, which now means the atheist has the burden of proof to prove both of those points. They at the very least have to prove that God would have left more evidence than he has. How are they going to prove that? That's a very difficult thing to prove. And secondly, they'd have to prove that the evidence has been completely and thoroughly and sufficiently searched. Again, not so easy to prove, but at least the point is they do have to prove that before they can draw the conclusion God does not exist. Before they can use the absence of evidence means evidence of absence of God. So if Scriven is correct, one's justification for atheism depends on the probability that God would leave more evidence of his existence than what we have, and the probability that we have comprehensively surveyed the field for evidence of his existence. And so this clearly puts the burden of proof on the atheist now to prove at least those two points. Now, a detailed discussion of those two points goes beyond what we can cover in this lecture, and it actually gets quite interesting. It gets into the area called the hiddenness of God, argument against God. But we just don't have time to cover that. But it is covered in the book Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview. But again, it clearly puts the burden of proof on the atheist, and that's my point in this talk, that to prove that God would have left more evidence than he has, and the area has been thoroughly, sufficiently searched. When evidence neither confirms nor disconfirms the existence of an entity, the proper intellectual response is to reserve judgment, to say, I don't know. That's what we call soft agnosticism. I don't know. I'm open to the possibility, but I'm just not sure. Evidence, not sure one way or the other, but I'm not ruling it out. That's the proper intellectual response. Not draw the negative conclusion that the entity does not exist. But that's what atheism does. That's what the atheists do with respect to God. And to do otherwise, or to do that is to commit the fallacy, argument from ignorance. Just from my ignorance of any evidence, you're not allowed to draw the conclusion that the entity doesn't exist. You should reserve judgment. For example, would have been inappropriate and mistaken to deny the existence of the Higgs boson particle. You may have heard about that in the news in the last year or so. Just because there was no empirical evidence for that particle until the past summer, even though the mathematical formulas kind of implied that it existed for the last 30, 40 years, as Dr. Craig points out, the lesson of the Higgs boson particle is that physical undetectability is no proof of non-existence. And something can be objectively there and real, even pervasively present, like the Higgs boson particle, even when we have no direct evidence of its presence. So the only real default position here is soft agnosticism. I don't know. Reserve judgment, not atheism. Third, but the atheist says, but wait a minute. I merely lack the belief that God exists. I'm not claiming to know that God does not exist. This is the tricky one. This is the one that really sends me up the wall and sent me to do some more research. During the dialogue portion of our debate at the Atheist Convention, when my colleague Paul presented or pressed for some clarification on the atheist position, one of our debate opponents clarified his position by asserting that he was not saying he believed there is no God, only that he did not believe there is a God. Now, this may sound like meaningless philosophical hair-splitting to some, but it's an important distinction to the atheist. Problem is, this lack of belief distinction still cries out for some clarification. What exactly do you mean by that? What precisely does someone mean when they say, it's not that I believe there's no God, it's just that I do not believe there is a God? There's an inherent ambiguity in the statement that the atheists take advantage of in the debates. So in doing some research on this subject, I came across a fascinating article by my former atheist professor, Kai Nielsen, formerly from the University of Calgary. He calls it On the Definition of Words of the Words Atheism and Atheist. And I don't have time to tell you the story about Nielsen. Anyway, he writes the following. A lack of belief definition for atheism is a bad definition. This is an atheist saying this now, okay? It's a bad definition for many reasons. It's not commonly used. It's not defined that way in any reputable dictionary. It's too broad because most agnostics and babies don't consider themselves atheists, and they lack belief in God. And it makes no sense for an ism, like an atheism, to be based on a lack of belief. Because ism means belief. The word actually means belief. So these atheists are usually motivated to redefine the word atheist, he says, because they want to enlarge the definition of atheist to include as many people as possible, or because they perceive it as to be an advantage in debates with theists, which is exactly what I think is the case. Unfortunately, and this is him talking, some of these people have used lies and distortions to support their opinions, and some have made, again, this is his words, extremely ignorant and grossly incorrect statements that may reflect badly on all atheists. He says, Group A believes that gods do not exist. Those are what we call atheists, he says. Group B neither believes that at least one God exists, nor do they believe that gods do not exist. And this would include agnostics, babies, undecided, people have never even thought about the question. And then Group C believes at least one God exists, and that would be theists, like me. He says the people who want a lack of belief definition would define Group B as atheists as well. They combine Group A and Group B and try to make them all into atheists. Well, he says, while most people and all reputable dictionaries do not. And one of the main problems, he says, with the lack of belief definition is that it's too broad. If someone told you they were an atheist, you would still not know, given this definition, if they were agnostic, undecided, believe that gods don't exist, or have never even thought about the question. This makes the word nearly useless, he says. I love this because it's an atheist, right, making all these points. I personally, he says, do not know anyone who considers babies atheists because they lack belief in gods. I also don't know of any people who are agnostic or undecided about the existence of God who call themselves atheists. There actually are people who do that. This is part of what atheists do these days. He says, the lack of public acceptance for a lack of belief definition of atheism is reflected in the fact that no reputable dictionary has a lack of belief definition for either atheism or atheist. However, and again, his words, this has not kept a few morons from incorrectly claiming that various dictionary definitions have lack of belief definitions. Some people who want to redefine the word atheism and atheist to mean a lack of belief in the existence of gods have used, again, his words, incredibly stupid arguments to support their position. Well, I mean, I couldn't let this pass. I had to use some of this material, right? So here's some of his stupid arguments that he says his atheist colleagues use. And he has a number of them. I'm not giving all of them, just a few of them. Under definitions of atheism, stupid argument number one, he says the etymology, that is sort of the history of the word atheism, means a lack of belief, is what these atheists are saying. And he responds, a commonly repeated error is that the word atheism was derived from the prefix a, or a, meaning without, and the word theism, meaning belief in God. Therefore, they claim the word atheism means without a belief in God, which sounds like lacking a belief in God. And this is what they say in debates. So this is what the word has meant all along, ever since it was invented by Thomas Huxley in the late 19th century. They often compare it to the word amoral, which is different than the word immoral. We say that someone is amoral, we don't mean that they're immoral. We just mean that they lack morality, not that they're acting in an immoral way. But even that analogy doesn't work, because amoral means no morality present. Therefore, an atheist, an atheist, should mean no God present, which is not just a lack of belief, it's the claim that there is no God present. But anyway, Nielsen says, This whole definition is incorrect, because the etymology of the word atheism actually derives from the Greek word atheos, meaning godless, and the ism suffix, which can roughly mean belief, was added later. So the etymology of the word means godless belief, not without a belief in God. And he cites a couple of etymologies from two respected dictionaries. And then secondly, stupid argument number two. Most dictionaries define atheism as lack of belief, is the claim. And I'm going to do this one quite quickly. If I had the PowerPoint, it would be better for you to see this, but I'll go through this quite quickly. He says, I see this lie quite often on the internet. The truth of the matter is that no reputable dictionary has a lack of belief definition. Merriam-Webster Online defines atheist as one who believes there is no deity. That's not lack of belief. And atheism as a disbelief in the existence of a deity, or the doctrine that there is no deity, and agnostic as one who is not committed to believing either the existence or the non-existence of God, or of gods or a god. The Cambridge Dictionary of American English defines atheist as someone who believes that God does not exist. And atheism, the belief that God does not exist. The Oxford English Dictionary, atheist, one who denies or disbelieves the existence of God. The Columbia Encyclopedia, 6th edition, 2001, atheism, denial of the existence of God or gods and any supernatural existence, to be distinguished from agnosticism, which holds that existence cannot be proved. And agnosticism, they add, is not to be confused with atheism, which asserts there is no God. From the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is a standard work for philosophers, on the article on atheism and agnosticism, they say atheism means the negation of theism, the denial of the existence of God, not just the lack of belief. So he's right. No reputable dictionary or encyclopedia defines atheism that way. Stupid argument number four in his numbering. I'm skipping numbers here. The argument is only atheists get to define what the word atheist means. Well, this argument, he says, is absurd for two reasons. First of all, words are defined by common usage, not by the people who fit that definition. For example, the word handicapped is defined by common usage, not just by handicapped people, right? Secondly, he says, a lack of belief definition for the word atheist would include so many agnostics, babies, infants, and the undecided that the self-identified atheists would be a very small minority. Babies and infants make up a majority of the lack of belief atheists, if that's the way it's defined, and I haven't heard any of them who could express a coherent definition of atheism. So the idea of defining atheist as one who only lacks belief that there is a God is not justified. But in addition, and here's where some of my thinking has come into play here, this is not the atheist's actual position. This is really not what they believe. Why don't they defend what they really believe in these debates? It's not the actual position of either the atheist debater or the people that you're talking to on a one-to-one basis. It may not be in a formal debate situation, but it's in your personal conversations that you have. They all slip up at some point, and the real view comes out in the fact that they do believe the proposition God exists is false. Not just that they lack belief in it, but they think it's false. Dillahunty, in the debate, during the cross-examination portion of the debate, said the following, quote, "The fact that there could possibly be a God is not a compelling enough reason to think that it's actually true. So, while I admit there may possibly could be a God, I not only don't believe there is one, but I believe there is not." Completely contradicting what he had said earlier, where he said, I do not believe that God does not exist, I merely lack the belief. Now he actually says, I actually believe there is no God. Then he said, yes, I believe there is no God. Do I actually believe there are no gods? Yes. But at this point, and I had to go back to study the debate tape to get this. I didn't get this during the debate because it was so convoluted trying to figure out what he's saying. But later on when I went through it, I realized what he had done. At this point, he calls that view that there are no gods, or I believe there is no God, he calls that view anti-theism. That is the negation of theism. But in the debate, he said he was only going to defend what he called atheism, which he defined as merely the rejection of theism or the lack of belief, and therefore did not require proof. He did not have to give any proof in the debate in the sense of a positive, because it wasn't a positive case. It was only the rejection of the theistic case. So he's redefining words here to his own liking so that he can use the label atheism that most people think means God does not exist. He can use that word still, but he's defined it completely different than anyone else does, or any dictionary or any encyclopedia does. So here's how you deal with someone who's doing this. Here's how you can take this now and use it in your personal conversations if you find someone taking this route, saying, I don't have anything to prove. All the proof's on you. All the burden's on you. I just say that you haven't proved your case, and I can conclude God does not exist. Here's how you respond. When you're having this conversation, the question or a debate is about the question, does God exist? The word atheism, it wasn't part of our debate question. What is the person's answer to the question, does God exist? And if you actually push them on that, it's no. It's no. It's not, I don't know, or I only lack belief. And if the answer to the question to does God exist is no, then they have to give you some proof, have to give you some reasons for that. Now, to try and get out of the burden of proof by saying, but I'm here to defend atheism, which I define as only the rejection of theism, not the negation of theism, is not only redefining atheism, but it's to not answer the question. You're not actually answering the question, does God exist anymore? No one asked him to defend atheism, but to answer the question, does God exist? What's your answer? And then give us reasons for your answer, whatever it is. So this applies to you in your personal conversations too, even though I've used, you know, my debating experience as the springboard here. Don't let someone sidetrack you on different definitions of atheism. Just make it about the question, does God exist? Just totally get away from definitions of atheism and say, what's your answer to the question, does God exist? So this is ultimately just a debating strategy, I think, to avoid having to provide a positive case for their real position. To me, there just seems to be something disingenuous about calling yourself an atheist, representing atheists at an atheist convention, and then pretending that atheism only means the absence of belief in that God exists, not the presence of the belief that God does not exist. Everyone knows that atheists do, in fact, hold the statement, God does not exist, to be true, and Dilhunty admitted he actually did hold that to be his real position, and God does exist, to be false. Just, you know, you just read their stuff. So I merely lack a belief in God is also not a claim about God's existence. Like I said, it doesn't answer the question. It's only a statement about the psychological state of their mind. You got to force them to answer the question. Just telling everyone that atheism is nothing more than the view you do not believe there's a God, or you merely lack a belief in God, is not an answer to the question, does God exist? It's only a description about one's mental state. But the debate isn't about one's mental state. It's about the truth or the falsity of propositions like God exists or God does not exist. And so it's not answering the question, it's evading the question. If you're not answering the question with a yes, a no, or a maybe, you might say, oh, I'm just agnostic on it, then you're not answering the question of the debate or the personal conversation that you're involved in. You're actually evading the answer. And so this brings up the point of ambiguity again. There's something ambiguous about this whole strategy that is useful to them. And it works in a debate because it's so ambiguous. There's actually a logical fallacy that goes by the name of amphiboly, which basically means if your point is deliberately ambiguous, you're committing a logical error called amphiboly. I think that's what's going on here. When the atheist responds with saying, no, when I say I do not believe there is a God, I am answering the question, does God exist? This is where this ambiguity really helps him. Now, this is a little bit hard to follow, so really focus in here if you can. The atheist is correct. There is a logical difference between I believe X does not exist, and I do not believe X does exist. There is a logical difference between those two statements. But typically, when someone says, I do not believe that X exists, they mean they think the proposition X exists is false and would be expected to provide reasons for the denial of that proposition. Only if someone actually says or means, I believe God does not exist, is he answering the question, does God exist? Of course, this would then place a burden of proof on him to support his claim. But the atheist in our debate explicitly stated, this is not what he means. He only means, I do not believe, or I lack the belief, that God does exist. So this strategy of saying, I do not believe God exists, allows the atheist to appear like he's sincerely answering the question. Since most people interpret that to mean, I believe God does not exist, but at the same time, not making any claims that require a burden of proof upon him. Now, is the atheist sincerely mistaken here, or is this a deliberate deception on their part? Difficult to say for sure. And it might vary among different atheists, but it certainly is convenient. Now, Kai Nielsen agrees with me about this, and he lists this ploy as stupid argument number 6. Again, I'm skipping some of his arguments, so he lists it as number 6. I think this will make it very clear. I know that part was confusing. This will make it clear. The phrase, Tom does not believe in the existence of God, does not mean Tom believes that God does not exist. That's the argument the atheist is giving us. And Nielsen says this is a stupid argument. Why? Well, first of all, he shows his examples. I don't believe the mail has arrived means I believe the mail has not arrived. It does not mean I don't have any beliefs about the mail arriving. Or, I do not believe we missed the last bus means, I believe we did not miss the last bus. It does not mean I don't have any beliefs about missing the last bus. Or, I don't think the kicker can make a 55-yard field goal means, I think that the kicker cannot make a 55-yard field goal. It does not mean I did not think about the kicker making a field goal and had no beliefs about it. And fourth example, I don't believe the existence of deities means, I believe that deities do not exist. It does not mean I don't have any beliefs about the existence of deities. So this is an atheist, a well-known, strong proponent of atheism, saying, my colleagues are really messing up logically here. It's also important to notice that the atheists attempt to clarify their position by introducing this lack of belief claim is not actually a clarification, but it's rather a radical transformation of their position. The first response in the debate was that their view is a negative claim, remember, and that they don't shoulder any burden of proof. But now with this lack of belief response, our atheist is denying he's making any claim at all. And for that reason, he has no burden of proof. Well, which is it? Is it a negative claim or no claim at all? In order for this negative claim needs no proof defense to make any sense, they must have been making a negative claim in the first place that there is no God. Now they're saying they're not making a claim that there is no God. They got to choose one or the other. They can't have it both ways. So I've come to the conclusion the best way to solve this issue of the ambiguity of the atheist's lack of belief strategy is to ask them the following question. Can somebody give me an idea where we are in terms of time here? Maybe one of my volunteers? Nobody? What time is it? 1:15? So we're supposed to end right now? All right. Let me summarize this. This is my final point here. And this is something that I came up with that I think this is a good little strategy. Here's what I will say from now on in this situation. So you say you lack the belief that God exists. I will then ask the following question. Do you also happen to lack the belief that God does not exist? Now think about this for a minute. How are they going to answer that? If they say yes, I lack, not only do I lack the belief that God exists, which is their claim, but yes, I also lack the belief that God does not exist. That means they both lack the belief and do not lack the belief that God exists. Well, that's equivalent to having no opinion on the subject of God's existence whatsoever. And that's not atheism. That's soft agnosticism. So that's not going to help them very much. So what if they say, well, no, I don't actually happen to lack the belief that God does not exist. So you lack the belief that God exists, but you do not lack the belief that God does not exist. Now follow this. But the latter, if you do not lack the belief that God does not exist, That's equivalent to holding the belief that God does exist, logically. There is no middle ground between holding and lacking a belief. You either hold it or you lack it. And if they do not lack it, then they hold it. Therefore, since one does not hold to the positive belief that God does not exist, which is strong atheism, one has to shoulder a burden of proof for that claim. So, ask if they also happen to lack the belief that God does not exist, and they are in trouble. Okay? They are in trouble. So it follows that atheism and agnosticism are not identical positions here. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to combine atheism and agnosticism into one large group and include babies and infants and anybody who's never even thought about the subject and call them all atheists. And avoid answering the question, does God exist? But that just won't do. So, let me see here. I have to skip a couple of points. This is all premised on the assumption that there is no evidence at all for God's existence, by the way. And I don't concede that assumption. You know, no matter how many arguments we present, they just say, you haven't persuaded me. There's no evidence for God's existence. But they haven't given any refutations. They haven't refuted the arguments that we've given. They just say, you haven't persuaded me. But that may say more about them than it does about the arguments. All right? And so, again, in conclusion, I call again for my atheist friends to man up. Accept their share of the burden of proof on this issue of God's existence. And again, if they're using this strategy and not actually presenting arguments for God's existence, that tells us they know those arguments aren't any good. Because if they knew they were any good, you can be sure they would be using them. The fact that they're resorting to this lack of belief strategy tells us that they know we have the strongest case. That should give us some confidence when we're up there presenting the case for God.